Hello, my name's Richard Cox and I'm here with Tim Freak. We made a video last week and we enjoyed it so much we decided we'd try and do some more. So this week I'm going to ask Tim a bit about Zen. Tim, you've written a few books on Zen, but I'd like to get your personal kind of experience and opinions of it today. But before that, can you just define for everyone quickly what Zen is in its cultural context so they know what we're talking about?
Zen is the indefinable. I mean, that's kind of true, really. Just defining what Zen is probably one of the hardest things you could ask in its cultural context, actually. So Zen is a form of Buddhism, which, according to legend, was brought to China by Bodhidharma, who's a kind of legendary sage. Who doesn't have much of a big impact actually in his own lifetime, but is a quirky figure, who sets the seeds for what will become something called Chan in China, which then eventually comes this form of Buddhism reaches across to Japan, and that's where it gets called Zen. So it's a form of Buddhism, and it's Mahayana Buddhism. So it's come from the northern tradition, the Greater Vehicle, as it's called.
Okay, and 1400 years after that, you're a young man in Yeovil. It's the 1970s. How do you get into Zen? How do you come across it?
Well, it's the 1970s, and I guess living in the West Country of England in Yeovil, the 60s arrived in the 1970s, and what had been happening in the 60s was this explosion of Eastern spirituality. And I think the key figure probably for Zen is Alan Watts. His book on Zen, The Way of Zen, really made a big impact, and people were looking east for meaning, and there was this explosion of rebellious thought, and there's something inherent in one way of seeing Zen, which is very anti-authoritarian. It captured that anarchic spirit of the 60s, and it was you couldn't have gone any further east to bring something new in. So there was a real feeling of that in the air. Zen was in the air, as all Eastern spirituality was. And I'd had my spontaneous awakening, which I've written about and talked about a lot, when I was young, about 12, and then gone looking for what was that. And the place I ended up looking, which was already in the air, I didn't have to look far, in the counterculture, was Eastern spirituality, one important strand of which was Zen. And so I started talking to people, and I mean, I can remember going up to someone a little bit older than me, he seemed a lot older at the time, going, who understood Zen, apparently, and going, can you tell me about Zen? And I remember him looking at me very sagely. He was must be very young, actually, and going, you can't read about Zen. You have to find out for yourself. And me thinking, wow, that sounds great. I wonder what that is. And then that would start me off. And then coming across books like Zen Flesh, Zen Bones by Paul Reps, which is is still a classic. All those quirky little Zen stories, and that was
So
it.
it was obvious to you from the start that Zen was a different expression of this perennial kind of truth and related to this experience you'd had, that you've talked about on the hilltop and other kind of philosophies.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that developed quite soon for me because I was reading books like Aldous Huxley, The Perennial Philosophy, which was already starting the idea off in my head that all of these things were saying the same things in different cultures. But to begin with, it was just its sheer craziness, its audacity. And why I particularly like Zen is that it had started for me with my own questions and then my own direct experience of awakening. And here was a philosophy which was seemed to be anchored in a direct experience of awakening, which kept on going, throw all the rest out, come back to the just have that moment, the
So how do
Zen.
you think how do you perceive Zen contrasts with other kind of mystical philosophies, whether it's Advaita in India or the Christian mysticism? What's the kind of similarity and difference with Zen?
Well, it really depends how closely you look. You stand way back, and they're all kind of saying the same thing. Come up closer and you see there's cultural differences. Come up closer still and you see that within each tradition there's the whole range is actually in each tradition. So if we find the middle ground, which is the easiest place to contrast them, then there's this feeling in Zen that it's highly experiential, that it's not bogged down in dogma, that it really focuses on a kind of, what gets called crazy wisdom is a very central to it, in anything to wake you up, anything to wake you up, anything to wake you up, no rules. Actually, Zen isn't like that at all. And that's one version of Zen. That's what Alan Watts called beat Zen. You know, that was the Zen we wanted to hear about.
Yeah.
Because it reflected where we were at in the 70s and the 80s. Actually, you know, I've been to Japan now, and I've sat in Zen temples, and they're very conservative places. And it's not at all crazy and anarchic. It's people dressed up in there. It's priests. Sure. It's a priesthood.
Well, I've always wondered this, because the books you read here are all about rebels, right?
Yeah.
Like Ikkyu and the guy that breaks all the rules and burns statues of the Buddha or the scriptures or something. But that does rather imply there's a whole structure there to rebel against. And you never read about it, but it's just always...
Very good insight, and that's exactly right. So what you've got is this tension, which is actually in all traditions, because it's actually a tension in humanity, between something which is about, you know, which is conservative, and something which is iconoclastic. So we associate in the West Zen with our iconoclastic spirit, and it's definitely there. The other thing is that, you know, there's a big difference, I think, in Chan and what happens in Japan.
Oh, right.
China and Japan are very different cultures. So in China, the early Zen seems far more Taoist. Something which Alan Watts pointed out was that he couldn't find any reference to meditation at all.
Right.
So, was it about sitting, looking at white walls then? There is now stories about Bodhidharma spending, you know, 9 years or whatever in silence staring at a white wall. But you don't hear about that until the 11th century, 12th century. So earlier than that, we don't know what it feels like. It's much more organic, much more influenced. So it's a meeting, really, as one might expect, of this new Buddhism coming in with this much more fluid, naturalistic Taoist culture, where it really does feel like it's like that whole relax and be natural. But by the time it reached Japan, it's sit with a straight back and have people hit you with a big stick to keep you awake, which much more reflects that Japanese culture. But even in Japan, there's a lot of crazy figures as well.
Yeah, I noticed that, because Zen was one of the first things that really interested me, because this talk of being very in the moment seemed to resonate with experiences I'd had. And that's the first kind of time I picked up on people writing about something that related to an experience I'd had. So I latched onto that. But there seemed to be this almost unspoken contrast between the people whose quotations would appear in books from way back in time, and this kind of very natural flowing feel to it, and the writer of the book itself, who would be much more rigid, and you've got to kind of force yourself into the moment and try and stay there as hard as you possibly can. And
that tension, you know, permeates right through. I mean, you know, Alan Watts ended up being a spokesman, especially after his experiences of LSD, for a very naturalistic Taoist form of Zen. He was very influenced by D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen scholar, who I never really related to, who also ended up being very critical of Alan Watts, because he felt like he thought it wasn't about how D.T. Suzuki seemed to think it was about how you did the meditation properly. Whereas I don't think Alan Watts thought meditation was even important, necessarily. Interesting that the probably of all of the modern Zen teachers, the one that touched me the most deeply was Shunri Suzuki, who came across and taught in America, and there's a collection of his talks called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I absolutely loved and still do. And what you get from him is somewhere in between, really. He was very supportive of Alan Watts and much more able to, but he was also definitely in the Zen tradition. He was a trained Zen master and was able to, you know, to talk about it from that perspective as well. So there's a whole range, and that's just the way it always is when you get up close. So I think the key thing with that is my attitude is, okay, well, in that case, we should cherry pick the things which speak to us today in our culture and say, thank you very much, we'll have those.
I know you've written in other contexts of Eastern spirituality about a baby in a bathwater effect. That's true of Zen too. You think that we've got to decide?
I think it's true of all of them. I mean, that may be a personal thing. I mean, I'm sure there's some people that get really drawn to the formalities of things. I don't. I really want the immediate experience. So what I look to Zen for is that its ability to just go and just cut through. Again, in Zen itself, you know, there are two distinct paths. There's the immediate path and the gradual path. So the same dichotomy you get with all the rest, the gradual path, the image is to clean the mirror, clean the mirror, clean the mirror, mm-hmm. work on yourself. The direct path is just see right now. Don't wait a moment. See it now. Look at this moment now. So, I mean, I actually think we need both of those. I'm a paralogical thinker. I think they come together. That we don't have to fight between which is right. But the thing I look to Zen to is its ability to give me that Zen moment. And so when I wrote, for instance, Lucid Living, I think my understanding of Zen was a massive influence. Right. What I wanted to do in that book was not have any reference to anyone or anything. I just wanted your experience right now in this moment as simple and as deep as it can possibly be. And for me, that's my Zen book. That's mm-hmm. that's not a book about Zen. I've written two or three books, which I hope are really good, about Zen. But that is my Zen right. book.
Does that contrast? I'm really curious to know, there is this feel in Zen, perhaps associated with the gradual path, of enlightenment being something you attain maybe over a 20-year period or a 20,000 lifetime period, and it's something you get, and it's like the switch goes on, and that's kind of quite an Eastern way of looking at it. Is that contrast there too, then, of because Lucid Living is written more in the vein of this is something you sink into, come away from, sink into again, and it's something that's always accessible but not something that you attain in that sense.
Yes, there's a definite attainment idea which exists in the East, which is this arriving, and it goes right back to the idea of the circle of death, of samsara, of birth and death, that you can come off the cycle, that we're stuck in an illusion, all of those very common actually in the whole of esoteric philosophy. I don't like them. I feel like we've grown out of that, so I don't relate to that at all now. I much prefer what arose in the East in that respect, which was the idea of ever evolving, ever moving forward into greater communion mm-hmm. with the One or with God, and that your humanity was part of that journey, not something to be left behind or overcome or eradicated even. So that Eastern model of enlightenment, it seems there's a hardness to it. I mean, again, not in Taoism, of course. Taoism doesn't have that. So that's why I'm much more drawn to that Chinese way of thinking. By the time it reaches Japan, then it really is. I mean, there's stories about Zen masters who kill their students with sticks to wake them up. And when questioned about this, goes, yes, but, you know, for everyone I kill, one becomes enlightened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, these are probably apocryphal stories, but, you know, there was a time when I would read those stories and think, wow. And now, as an older man, I read those stories and think, whoa, that is...
Yeah, I remember having that experience of really being drawn in when I was very young to that, and thinking, you know, that there's a story about them cutting a cat in half as two groups of monks arguing a cat. The monk cut the cat in half, and then another monk comes in, puts his shoes on his head and walks out of the room, and I'm sitting there just baffled by this. But also, as I got a bit older, disturbed by my ability to be taken in by that, and you think, well, this is how cults start, you know, because I would have believe that for a while there, that of, you know, anything a Zen master did would have been justifiable because it's helping someone slip into this super state of consciousness. And
yeah, and that's the way it has become in a lot of cults, and I suspect it's like that in a lot of Eastern cults, like it is in Western cults, and certainly it is in the guru cults. I mean, that so that once you've got that, it is a dangerous idea. There's something like as a young man, I did find it attractive. There was a craziness there that was a way of going, breaking through convention. And it works too. I mean, I can remember times when I would be stuck in some repetitive action, either in an argument or just in myself. And I would stop and stand on a table and put a shoe on my head. And it would work. I would be in a different state of mind. It would be like, wait, Tim, what are you talking? You know, why are you stuck in this? You know, it's a certain way. It's great in arguments because, you know, you just make a fool of yourself and then everything just cracks up. And so it's good. But also it's potentially, and the Bodhidharma, I mean, the story with Bodhidharma is that he only accepts his student, it becomes the second patriarch of Zen, after a student cuts off his left arm.
No one's done that on one of your retreats yet, have they?
Well, Richard, I was going to mention that if you really wanted to get what I was saying, then I was thinking maybe you could do your right. No, thank God for that, because, you know, it's like, again, what's of interest to me now is, like you've said, looking back, why did I, what made me go, ooh, that's dedication, rather than, whoa, I mean, why didn't I just read that and go, okay, well, I'm not interested in that, that's nutty. And what that tells me about me. I'm glad I did keep going with it, though, because also in Zen, I mean, there is something, it's so anti-authoritarian. I mean, it, you know, and as somebody who grew up with that spirit, my generation and the generation before, I think, were particularly caught up in that. There is something so sweet about it, and rebellious and naughty. Naughty, I think. There's a naughtiness which is kind of attractive.
Okay, Tim, well, to finish it off then, thank you for all that. What's your favourite little Zen story or koan?
Ooh, God. Oh, that's one to drop on me. What's my favourite? There's so many, isn't there? So many. I think... I mean, I'm tempted to tell some of the funny ones, but I'm not. We've had a good laugh, and we've talked about the things in Zen which are good and bad. So I'm going to end with one which I think is actually profound and deep, which is the koan. A koan, for people that don't know, a koan is a question where to answer it, really, you have to see reality in a new way. So you don't just come out with the answer. It's like you have to actually see reality differently. So the koan that I think is amazing is, what is your original face? Sometimes it's, what was your original face before you were born? And I think what that does is it pushes me back to look at myself. I noticed something which Douglas Harding, who was very influenced by Zen, the English teacher, is dead. I noticed something which he saw in an enlightenment moment, which is, I can't actually see my own face. That what I see is a body with the world on top. And that's what I actually perceive myself with my eyes, which is kind of quirky. And then it throws me back into this presence of awareness, which is looking at everything. And at that point, it feels like my original face is the whole world. That everything which I'm experiencing is what I am. And that pre-exists Tim. It pre-exists him in this moment. And I suspect it pre-exists in time also. So there's a whole meditation which unfolds from that koan, which I have found and still do, absolutely amazing to dwell on and contemplate.
Mine is much simpler than that. It's peaceful pond, frog jumps in, plop.
Basho. Isn't that great? Those moments, that moment where you just, that's what Zen is so good at. And in the haiku, you just get it. I mean, that's the whole thing we haven't even talked about, which is, actually, I think for most people, Zen is an aesthetic. Zen is black and white pictures. Zen is minimalism, which is just huge for us. I mean, I'm sitting in front of an Apple computer, which is full of Zen design, and it's minimalism. Sitting in a Zen garden when I was in Kyoto this year, and just, And there's a whole, they've given us an awful lot in terms of just how we perceive reality through aesthetics as well, which is amazing. So, okay, well, I'm going to give you another one then to end with.
Okay.
The other great koan I love is just the word mu, which means not. And that is really, it's the Zen version of the via negativa, which is found in Christianity and also, of course, in Advaitic philosophy in India, which is just looking at everything and going, not that, not that. What am I? I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm not my body. I'm not my thoughts. I'm not the world. And just everything. No, 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 no. Until there's this something remains, which you can't say what it is. And that's what we are. And why I felt that was a great one to end our conversation was that's what we started with, because that's Zen. And you said, what is Zen? And I went, it's a thing you can't define. And I think that's right. It's what's left after you have mewed, gone mew to everything. Mew, mew. everything, every thought, new. No, until there's just,
Well, thank you, Tim, for that. I've really enjoyed that discussion. I hope other people have too. And if so, we'll make some more videos. So we were thinking next week of recording one on the guru, the concept of gurus, the good and bad in that. So if anyone has anything they'd like me to ask him about that, leave a comment on the Facebook page or beneath this YouTube video, and I'll put something together. Oh, and you can purchase Tim's books on Zen from the website. We'll put a link beneath the video. You don't need an ebook reader. You can read them right at the desktop. Zen Made Easy. I think does what it says on the tin, really. It makes Zen quite easy and accessible. So, okay, Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's been a real pleasure.